Good evening and welcome to the Ecology Hour. My name is Tim Bray. With me is Dr. Robert Spies, my co-host, and we have a great guest lined up tonight with some more insights into marine biology, looking at some of the fascinating interactions in our nearshore and offshore marine environment. We've got a really interesting topic for tonight. Bob, do you want to introduce tonight's guest?
Yes, we're really pleased to have Heather Lee Wanag from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. She's an associate professor there, and she's what we call a comparative physiologist. And so she's interested in the physiology of animals and how it interacts with the ecological situations. And she has studied comparative physiology, thermal biology, physical ecology, and animal behavior, and particularly honing in on thermal regulation and marine mammals. And she's worked on fur seals, Weddell seals, sea otters, harp seals, even lizards. And so we're really pleased to have you here. And tonight's we're going to be talking about elephant seals, really fascinating marine mammals. So welcome to our program.
Thank you.
We usually ask our guests to tell us a little bit about how they got into what they do, and maybe they have a childhood experience that kind of steered them into ecology, or maybe they learned later in life, or maybe they were a surfer and got interested in the ocean that way. But tell us a little bit about how you got into this particular field, Heather.
Sure. So yes, I always liked animals as a kid, but I think what got me into the biology was sort of a fascination specifically with marine mammals, because as we know, life evolved in the oceans, and there was a big breakthrough when organisms made it out onto land and then filled all the niches on land. But marine mammals, after millions of years of evolution on land, turned around and went back to live in the ocean. And there are so many challenges with that because of all the adaptations to live on land, things like lungs and being quadrupedal and all of these things. And now they're trying to make it in this completely different environment. And that just fascinated me. And then that's where I started honing in on the idea of how does this animal that we know is warm-blooded, but an endothermic animal, how does that animal deal with the challenge of the marine environment, which is typically so much colder and water's pulling heat out of its body faster than in air? And that's what got me started down this whole thing with marine mammals.
Cool. Yeah, that is a really fascinating evolutionary history, isn't it? First you climb out of the ocean, and then after about 100 million years, you just decide that was a huge mistake and let's go back.
Or there's better food in there.
Right.
There you go. Yeah. And so you've been, you and your students have been studying some northern elephant seals. And I know that you're honed in on a group of a haul out, I guess you'd call it, at Piedras Blancas near San Luis Obispo.
Yes. So currently, that's the largest mainland breeding site for northern elephant seals. There are larger breeding sites on islands off of our shores. But elephant seals are super fascinating for so many reasons. But one of them is that they're a real conservation success story because humans hunted them to near extinction. I mean, really, really on the brink of extinction in the late 1800s. So as far as we understand, there may have been about 100 individuals left.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. And we hunted them for their blubber. Well, I say we, but humans hunted them for their blubber. And then when protection started to go into place. So we think maybe 100 individuals on Guadalupe Island off the coast of Mexico. And then the Marine Mammal Protection Act came around and we weren't able to hunt marine mammals anymore. And they bounced back from that to over 200,000 individuals now from just 100. And about 25,000 of them are at Piedras Blancas currently.
That's an amazing story. Another fantastic conservation success from the 1970s, huh?
I could imagine Guadalupe Island was not very visited back in the day, and maybe that was it gave them a little bit of a toll to survive, and then until we were smart enough to figure out the Marine Mammal Act and get protection.
Yeah, although my students asked about it, and I read one of the older papers from the early 1900s, and this was the mindset then. They said that they thought the animals were extinct, but they found, I don't know, something like 6 or 7 individuals on Guadalupe Island. So they killed them to put them in the museum.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way since then. I mean, I understand preserving for history, but thankfully, apparently most of them were still in the water.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about let's give listeners a little background in elephant seals. Many people here probably aren't super familiar with them, even though they do occur here off the Mendocino coast, but they're pretty rarely seen. You kind of have to get out on the ocean and look for them to find them here, but they're really a fascinating creature. Give us a little, what are they? I mean, how are they different from other seals? What's their evolutionary history, and why are they special?
Sure. So pinnipeds, I'm going to start with pinnipeds. Pinnipeds are seals and sea lions and fur seals, which are in the same family as sea lions, and walruses. So that's a whole order of critters that we think are all related to each other. I think folks go back and forth about whether they're more closely related to mustelids, so weasels and otters, or to bears. I think bears are winning right now in the molecular phylogeny, but that has gone back and forth. But we know that there was one event where some ancestor to pinnipeds sort of made its way into the water and started becoming more marine. And they are called pinnipeds because that means flipper-footed or feather-footed. And they do have 4 flippers, but the different groups move around differently now that they've split from each other. So the 3 families are the walruses and the true seals, and then the eared seals, which have both fur seals and sea lions in them. And elephant seals are true seals. And those are, I would say, pretty derived. I think they're the most derived of the 3 families, meaning that they've had a lot of changes since they're split from the other 2 groups. And there are certain features, if you want to tell them, from other pinnipeds. So unlike sea lions and fur seals, they don't have external ear flaps anymore, but the inside parts of their ears work very similar to ours. So they can still hear in air and in water. They just don't have the outside part, the little pinnae, like where you get your ear pierced. And they no longer are able to rotate their ankles forward and walk on all 4s on land, which the other 2 groups can do. So they move on land in a sort of an inchworm fashion, which is one of my favorite scientific terms. It's called galumphing.
That is actually the scientific word for that?
That's correct.
I did not know that.
And so, but it looks like an inchworm, but they can get going pretty fast, actually. And and the reason they have to move like that is because they can't rotate their back feet forwards and walk anymore. So they drag their back flippers behind them. But those are the flippers that they use to swim. So on land, they look a bit awkward, but that's because they're really more adapted for swimming at this point. And they're very efficient swimmers, and they're able to get thrust on every stroke because they alternate which flipper is spread. So the outside flipper is spread and the inside flipper is tucked. And I know folks can't see it, but as it goes back and forth, it makes sure that every side-to-side motion gives them forward movement, similar to a fish, but with 2 flippers instead of a single fin. So they're able to move really fairly quickly in the water, and they definitely look more agile in the water than they do on land. So elephant seals are in this true seal group. They're called elephant seals because they have an enlarged proboscis or nose. It is their nose, so they're 2 nostrils go through this really enlarged proboscis. And there are 2 species of elephant seal the southern elephant seal, which is all the way down to Antarctica, but also comes up into South America, and the northern elephant seal, which is the species that lives off of our coast. And we do believe that they're sister species, but they are in completely separate hemispheres now. And northern elephant seals are the second deepest diving pinniped, only to their cousins, the southern elephant seal. So they're quite incredible divers, particularly for pinnipeds. They don't think they win across the board for marine mammals, but they're very deep divers. So they're very well adapted to being honestly more underwater than above the water at this point.
They have to compete with sperm whales for the deepest
sperm divers. Whales and beach whales.
Yeah,
maybe.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But how deep?
But
do
they're
the
second deepest diving pinniped. I think regularly they can go up to a mile deep, and I think the longest recorded breath hold is somewhere around 2 hours.
That's remarkable.
They're pretty incredible critters.
I understand that they can be down for an hour and a half, 2 hours, come up and kind of take a couple of breaths and then dive again. So they're spending 98% of their time underwater.
That's right. They spend most of their time underwater. And actually being at depth is the safer place for them because most of their predators can't dive that deep. Uh-huh. So if they're very deep, then they're avoiding their predators. And not my study, but a group recently confirmed what we had suspected based on the shape of dive records, that they sleep underwater. So there were dives that they called drift dives or processing dives. And the characteristic of those dives is that the seal will dive pretty rapidly down to about 200 meters below the surface. And then the dive shape would change where they really just look like they're kind of floating instead of actively swimming. And it turns out that they are sleeping. They're taking a little nap. And those are usually somewhere around 20 minutes in length. So they're just taking these little naps to refresh themselves because they spend months at sea. They don't really come ashore at all when they're out on their foraging migrations. And so that's the way that they get sleep, which we know is an important thing for animals to do.
Right.
They must have some kind of incredible respiratory physiology to do what they do with that kind of diving.
They do. They share with many of our deep divers the ability to essentially collapse all of the exchange parts of the respiratory tract, the parts that would exchange with the blood. And that helps to prevent it from being crushed by the depth, but also we think prevents the bends, which is a sickness that human divers get. Now, part of the problem with human diving is that we are also breathing compressed air, but that pushes nitrogen into your blood. And then if you come up too quickly, the nitrogen can bubble out and cause you pain and also damage to your joints typically. And elephant seals, as far as we know, do not get the bends. And we think one of the ways they do it is by allowing the lungs to stay away from the gas exchange surface, from the blood vessels, and the nitrogen can't get pushed into the blood that way.
So they, like sperm whales, they just collapse their lungs when they die.
They just collapse their lungs. That's right.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Remarkable adaptation.
Don't they do some interesting things too with the red blood cells and, you know, the how they circulate and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, and I want to mention on the respiratory front before we get into the circulation that one of the substances that we also make as humans, but that seals need, is surfactant, which is this substance that basically breaks up the surface tension inside the lungs so that the little alveoli don't stick to themselves like tissue paper would stick to itself. And they have to make lots of it. We actually can't live without it. We need it. It's the problem with preemie human babies is that we don't make surfactant until about, I think, 8 months into gestation as humans. And so babies born too early can't reinflate their lungs because they don't make surfactant. So they have to wait till they're able to do that. Seals have to make lots of it. And that helps them to reinflate those lungs when they surface after they've collapsed all of those little alveoli. So that's a super important substance. And so you'll see a lot of deep diving seals look really snotty, and it's actually surfactant literally coming out of their noses because they have to make so much of it that it's kind of a, there's a little bit of lipid in it, so it looks kind of a, like a greasy substance, but it's this stuff that allows them to collapse and reinflate their lungs over and over again on all these dives that they're doing.
Interesting.
But then, yes, the circulation, they have a greater blood volume. They have more red blood cells. They have more hemoglobin per red blood cell. And they also have a lot of myoglobin in their muscles. And so all of these are adaptations for essentially storing more oxygen in places other than the lungs so that while they're at depth, they can rely on the oxygen that's already inside their bodies to keep them going until they're able to take a breath again.
Well, you mentioned the snot that you see sometimes. But I had a elephant seal molting on a beach not too far from my house. And it was up on the beach, and the first time I saw it, it had snot all over its nose. And it looked like it was in distress. You know, And I didn't know what was going on, so I phoned the Marine Mammal Center, and he said, "Oh, that's perfectly fine." And that's how I learned about elephant seals and how they molt and all that sort of thing.
Yes, they have a really unusual molt. It's called a catastrophic molt. And when they molt their fur, they actually molt little patches of kind of the top layer of skin with the fur, which is very unusual for mammals. Most mammals will just shed the hairs without being attached to anything. But elephant seals have all this peely skin with fur on it, and then they have the fresh fur underneath. And it makes them look really unpleasant when they're molting. And it looks like they might be in distress, but in fact, they're just going through this thing of having to refresh their fur.
And when they do that catastrophic molt, how long does it take to molt? And then how long does it take them to regrow all that fur?
Oh, I wish I had exact numbers for you.
Just approximate is fine, because it seems like they're really vulnerable at that time, because they're just stuck on the beach.
It's one of the two times that they have to haul out on the beach. So in terms of their life history, elephant seals are mostly at sea, and they come ashore for the breeding season and then again for the molt. And I would say for an individual, I don't have an exact number, but I'd say it probably takes them about a month. Or they hang out for a month, maybe not the whole time they're molting, but they hang out for about a month during the molt. And in that time, they're completing that catastrophic molt, and they do stay a little longer. So I would say the molt itself doesn't take a whole month, but they're on shore for that time. And the reason they need to be out of the water is that in order for that to happen, they need to allow their skin to be much warmer than what the water temperature would be. And when they're underwater, they don't send blood to the surface of their skin, and they allow their skin to get very cold. And cold cells don't divide or repair well. And so they have to be out of the water so that they can warm it up to closer to body temperature. Again, one of those things with these endothermic animals that it allows the cells to do their thing. So that's why they have to be out of the sea in order to complete their molt. Now, other pinnipeds can molt in the ocean, but because of the catastrophic molt in particular, they've got to warm up their skin. And so they have to be out of the water for that part so they can warm up and not lose all their body heat to the ocean.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And it's an unfortunate, I mean, it has obviously worked well for them for a long time, but as our beaches get more and more popular with humans and humans and their dogs and everything else, that strategy becomes more risky all the time, it seems.
Yes, and I think it's one of the reasons that most of our elephant seals are still on islands where there are fewer people. But because they're expanding still as a population, we're seeing them show up in new places. And some of them are where people are, including the one here. We do have seals here where, and I run into people who remember before the seals, I'm going to say came back. We don't know for sure if they lived along the shoreline here before, but we think they probably did. But they only arrived in Piedras Blancas in the early 90s. So there are folks who feel like their personal beach has been taken over by elephant seals. And some of them aren't too stoked about that.
Yeah, the conflicts that we always get, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially with a short human memories.
Up here we have a situation where the coyotes are harassing the harbor seals at their haulouts. And I think they're eating the afterbirth when they birth on the rocks and so forth. And is there anything like that? Is there any coyote or bear interactions with elephant seals while they're on land?
There can be. I don't think it's very common at our site. The bears don't make it out anywhere near the coast here. We do have black bears, but they don't really make it out to the coast. I've definitely seen canid footprints once in a while in the sand. I don't know how much the coyotes are influencing the elephant seals so much. The gulls are note for when a birth has happened, because they will immediately descend upon those placentas when a birth happens. So I think the gulls are on it, and maybe the coyotes don't get a chance. But I have heard rumors of that happening further north in California. Point Reyes maybe may have some issues, and I could be wrong. I know there was some anecdote about coyotes causing a problem and potentially biting the flippers of pups, trying to figure out what's going on with them. So it's definitely the potential for that to happen, especially as these animals either need to move further up because the shoreline is shifting with all of our storms, or the coyotes are getting more curious and trying to figure out what's happening with these seals.
Yeah, I think locally, Sarah Grimes of the NOAA Center for Marine Science has just recently worked with somebody else who was looking into the coyote interaction, and they were able to document a coyote actually doing exactly what we were talking about, going down the beach and basically chewing on the flippers on some of the pinnipeds. I can't remember if it was harbor seal or maybe sea lion, but the pups of those are small enough that coyotes can go after them. I would think a harbor seal, even a pup, is probably too big for coyotes to really mess around with. How large are the pups when they're born?
Harbor seal pups are quite small. Mm-hmm. Elephant seal pups are in the range of about 60 pounds when they're born. And then they get up to about 300 pounds in the 4 weeks that they're with mom before they wean.
No kidding. They gain 240 pounds in 4 weeks.
Something like that. It's pretty incredible. And mom is fasting the entire time that she's nursing and just transferring all her energy to her pup. That's something people don't think about with these animals, is that the entire time that they're on shore, they don't eat or drink anything. And so they're just relying on all the energy stored inside of them to do all of the activities that we see. The big males fighting over the females in the breeding season, and the females trying to defend their pups and feed their pups and keep them safe. And then the pups trying to grow, and they also, once they're weaned, have to wait 6 to 8 weeks more to finish developing their physiology before they're ready to get in the water. And they're just living off that blubber that mom gave them.
Wow.
Yeah, I was going to ask about what the females do on land, or any of them do on land when they're going through that molt for several weeks. And what do they do for fresh water? You know, I guess they just use it, whatever's in their tissues. Huh?
That's right. It's just all water from inside their bodies that is already stored. They don't eat or drink. They're fasting the whole time. And that's why during the molt, they aren't very active. They're mostly resting. It's just in the breeding season where they're going to use up all that energy while they're on land, because they need to go ahead and pass those genes on to the next generation. But during the molt, you'll see animals just laying on and next to each other and trying to get through that, because it does cost them energy to regenerate all those tissues. And then they are getting it all from that last foraging migration, basically.
Right. So how much weight does a female actually lose when she's raising a pup? It must be hundreds of pounds.
Yes. I don't remember the exact number, but it's more pounds than the pup gained.
Of course.
Right. Yes. So it's a large proportion of her body weight that she loses. Yeah.
Remarkable. You know, we run into this repeatedly in the animal kingdom, the extraordinary energetics of reproduction. I mean,
yes,
I'm a bird
guy. For the females,
so
and the males.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because in this case, the males haul out earlier than the females to start sort of figuring out who's going to be the beach master. And they're fighting, and they're doing all these activities with their huge bodies. So it costs them a lot of energy, because they are much larger than the females, and it has to cost them a lot of energy to galump with all the, and then to fight, because they will lift up their bodies and just really go at it if it's a real contender, to make sure that they get access to those females. And they'll stay to the very last female typically.
Yeah.
So they're really on the beach the longest for the breeding season. And it's one of the reasons, I know we were going to talk about where they go to feed. It's one of the reasons that the males do feed in a different area than the females, because they need to get the high energy food. But it's high risk, high reward, because the places that they feed are more coastal and more vulnerable to predators. And the females go out to the middle of the Pacific Ocean and they feed in very deep water, but not anywhere near the bottom, mostly on lanternfish, we think. Hmm. And so those are smaller fish and they need to get more of them to build up their energy, but it's much safer for them because the predators are not at those depths.
Sure.
So they're a little bit safer. Whereas the males need to get the bigger energy prey. Most of them go up the coast towards Alaska. Some animals, as you know, in biology, will buck the trends. Mm-hmm. But the general idea is the males go up the coast to Alaska and feed on the continental shelf. And the females feed what we call mesopelagically, which is super deep water, but not anywhere near the bottom. So they're feeding on deep water organisms. Some of them are cephalopods, but I think the primary part of their diet, from what we know from diet analysis, is lanternfish.
Amazing.
Lanternfish are loaded with oils, hence the name lanternfish. You can light them on fire when they're dry. If you've just joined us, we're talking to Heather Lee Wanog, associate professor at the Cal State San Luis Obispo, and a comparative physiologist studying thermoregulation, and we're talking about elephant seals.
And their remarkable physiological adaptations. Before we get, I think we're going to spend some time talking about these different feeding strategies, but let's get the listeners an impression of just, you know, what kind of sizes we're talking about, and also the size differential between the males and the females, because the males especially are really big.
They're really, really big animals. Yeah, so the females are somewhere in the range of about 1,500 pounds, and the males can be upwards of 5,000 pounds. And the big size dimorphism, or difference between the males and females, is because of their breeding system. They have a polygynous breeding system, so that means that one male mates with many females. And specifically in elephant seals, it's called female defense or harem defense polygyny. So he's not really guarding a physical territory on the land. He's guarding a group of females. And he's guarding them for the right to mate with them that breeding season. And they have physical fights over these females and over the ability to breed. And so the bigger the male, the more likely he is to be able to win a fight. And that's one of the evolutionary drivers of the difference in size between the males and the females.
Sure. Right.
And yeah, so I've seen males fighting films of them where they rear up almost on their back flippers, and then they can come forward, kind of vicious strikes on their competitor male. Yeah.
Yes, they bite at each other, and eventually these males develop what we call a chest shield, but it's really just a buildup of scar tissue all along their chest and all the way up next to their eyes from all the fights that they've had with other males.
Man.
And they'll practice fight when they're really young, but when they're really going at it, that's how they develop that chest shield, and it's scar tissue from all their battles.
Wow.
And they just go for it. They also like once in a while to tear at one another's noses. I think that that's sensitive. And when they're really getting into it with a competitor, then sometimes they'll go for that soft tissue that probably really bothers the other male.
Do those open sores get infected?
Well, elephant seals have an incredible ability to heal. And I think we are still trying to understand that physiologically. But, yes, there's the potential for it to get infected, but honestly, I rarely see that with them. They have these open wounds. Sometimes we see animals come ashore with just incredible wounds, maybe probably inflicted by predators. I mean, big shark bites, and sometimes flippers completely bitten off, and they just heal.
Wow. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, when they, if you get a 5,000 pound animal slamming itself into each other, there's a lot of energy being transferred there. And so they must need a tremendous amount of padding and shielding to survive that over and over again. So then when they take off after breeding, they do a really interesting thing. The males and females just go into completely different environments.
That's right. Yeah. So at least with the adults, the males follow the coastline and they're feeding. We don't know if they feed on the bottom, but they're feeding on the continental shelf. And we know they can dive deep. So they're probably able to reach the bottom there. And they're able to get larger prey items, which will help them when they're young to grow up to be a bigger male. And when they're older, to replenish all that energy that they used while they were on the beach. And the females go pretty much directly out to kind of the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We think they're using oceanographic features like fronts and water temperature and salinity to try to navigate their way to their prey, which are still in deep water, but not anywhere near the bottom. And they're feeding kind of in the middle of the water column and trying to avoid the predators out there.
So the females are actually diving below the photic zone and feeding in those mesopelagic organisms down maybe 1,000 feet or more.
Yes. Although I think lanternfish have a little bit of light that they generate sometimes, right? So they might be able to see them. I know they have big eyes and they are visual hunters, but they also use their vibrissae, which are their whiskers, as a sensory organ, and they can sense little vibrations in the water from their prey and be able to detect them even if there's no light and the prey doesn't have any light on it.
I thought that mctophids were part of the deep scattering layer, but I'm a little unsure. You know, they kind of migrate up and down.
Yes, up to the and surface we see at night. That's exactly right. And we see the diurnal dive patterns of the females following that migration of the prey.
How do you see that
on dive records? So I've seen other people's dive records, but folks have put out time depth recorders, which are little electronic devices. I think originally, I'm not sure on the elephant seals, but they were actually paper that got drawn on from the pressure.
Oh, my God.
Very, very, very long time ago. But now they are electronic devices that are encased in epoxy, and they have typically temperature sensors and a pressure sensor that allows us to figure out the depth that the animal was and over time. So basically we're looking at the depth of the animal over time, and that allows us to determine what we call a dive record, which is essentially showing us how the animal is diving in sort of a two-dimensional way. Even though they're living in a three-dimensional world, we're getting just how deep they're going and not the exact direction from these tags. But you can see that the dives are deeper when the prey are deeper, and then the dives get more shallow at the time that the prey kind of come up closer to the surface. And since we can follow that over time, we're seeing that happen at the correct times of day or night, respectively.
I know the females migrate out into the open Gulf of Alaska. I was under the impression from somebody, I think a biologist I talked to years ago, that they were actually doing a fair amount of feeding on the seamounts, because there's a seamount province out there. Do we know, is that incorrect, or is it they sometimes do it? Is it mostly pelagic feeding, or?
No, I've heard that as well. Yeah. I think there is some individual variability, and where they find the prey, they're going to potentially learn and go back to those places where they've been successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things that can happen with, if you're only tagging a few animals, and if you get individual differences in behavior, you might kind of come to the conclusion that record is goes for all the members of that species, where you just may be getting quite a bit of individual variation.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you tag both the males and the females, and so you can see the males diving to shallow, because if the males are feeding on the continental shelf, that's usually less than 400 feet. So they probably go all the way to the bottom.
They probably do, yeah. And again, like we just discussed, sometimes they'll go a little off the shelf, or some of them have gone out to where the females go, and vice versa. We do see the females go up to Alaska sometimes. So it's not cut and dry, but given the number of seals that have been tagged out of Año Nuevo by the folks at UC Santa Cruz, we have a very clear delineation between male and female, with some exceptions.
This is probably a good time to mention, I'll put on our website, ecologyhour.wordpress.com, some of the images. The reason we got in touch with you, Dr. Liwanag, was a great image that I saw showing the tracks that were created by these tags on the animals after they left the breeding grounds and moved out to their foraging grounds. And it was really a remarkable visual display of, one, how far they go. Their migration is really extensive, and two, this really divergent path between the males and females. And it caught my attention in part because, you know, they're feeding in totally different ecosystems. Feeding on the continental shelf is one thing, because that's a extremely food-rich resource area, and feeding in the open ocean, the Central Pacific, you got to work to get food out there. That's a different environment altogether, kind of a blue desert.
Right. The animals or the prey is not going to be in the same place every time. If you're going out into the middle of the ocean, it's going to shift around, and you've got to find how to get there and how to find it. A little more difficult, I think, than just following the coastline.
A lot more.
But I want to give credit to Sarah Keenly, who's my friend and colleague, because she's the one who made that map from, I think, her own and also other folks' data. And those were from satellite tracks. I didn't mention that, but that's what puts the third dimension on that. So the time depth recorders look at the depth of the animals below the surface, but satellite tags, which communicate with the satellite system above us, when the animals surface, they allow us to track where they're going horizontally. So what locations they're going to, away from the shore and back.
I was going to say, when we were studying the biological oceanography of the Gulf of Alaska, there's a particularly productive set of conditions right as the shelf breaks and goes down to the abyss. This very right along the, I think it's kind of with the Alaska Current, but it's kind of below the surface that goes all the way down there. And I'm wondering if that's where some of the males spend a lot of time, right on that shelf break.
That makes sense. Yeah, any place that they're going to get an aggregation of prey that they can work.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. I'm a bird guy, and they're kind of doing, you know, we see the same strategies in birds, and different birds pursuing those two different strategies. Some of them are adapted to the open ocean, and of course the birds don't have the ability that elephant seals do to make use of that depth column. So they're out there really covering ground, trying to find those scattered sources of food. So do the males not dive generally as deep as the females? It seems like they must not, because they're in an environment where there just isn't as much water under them as the females out in the
open. Well, they definitely can. Especially because just having a bigger body size gives them an ability to stay down longer. But it's possible that they're using that to spend more time as opposed to going deeper.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So they go down 300-400 feet, and then they can spend an hour down there chasing and ingesting prey.
Well, listeners, if you've just joined us, we're talking to Heather Liwanag, from associate professor at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and we're talking about elephant seals.
So talk about the you've mentioned predators and predation a couple of times, and these strategies that the elephant seals have to avoid predation. They're so big. What preys on them?
As far as we know, mostly white sharks and orcas.
Sure.
Formidable predators.
Yeah, indeed. We've seen, and probably many of our listeners have seen videos of the white sharks off the Farallons, really going for the elephant seals. There's some thought that they're a preferred prey for white sharks, right?
It would make sense. They have lots of high energy blubber, all packed up pretty neatly, and it makes sense to me that it would be that. We definitely see critters with shark bites. They also get a lot of cookie cutter shark bites, but the cookie cutter sharks aren't going to cause mortality. They're just going to cause these circular scars that we end up seeing them come back to shore with. Some of them have quite a few, but as far as we know, those aren't killing them. That it's going to be a white shark or an orca that can take down, especially the larger elephant seals.
Yeah,
we haven't talked too much about the distribution of these of the northern elephant seal. Where are the major? I know some of them, but where are the major haul out sites when they do come ashore for molting and for breeding? Along the Pacific coast.
So there's many sites off of the coast of Mexico. I should have it off the top of my head, but I'm not sure there are many mainland sites off of Mexico, but island sites off of Mexico. Collectively, the largest breeding colony for northern elephant seals is in the Channel Islands off of Southern California. They are on several of the Channel Islands, but I believe San Miguel and Santa Rosa have the two biggest breeding colonies for northern elephant seals. And they have been making their way up the coast. More recently, we've seen a new breeding site at King Range National Monument, which is pretty far north in California. And
that's just north of us. Yeah.
Yes.
King Range is just north of Mendocino.
And then there's a relatively new, very, very small breeding colony, maybe about between 25 and 40 individuals breeding at Vandenberg Space Force Base. So that just started in about 2016. And so we do see them hauling out occasionally more north of King Range. But as far as I know, King Range is the northernmost breeding colony, and that's relatively recently established, I think also around 2016.
So how do those new sites get established? I know in sea otters, it's kind of the young males that are just kind of looking for a new places to establish their territories that'll kind of settle into new areas. Is that true also for elephant seals?
We think that the stage where they explore new areas is happening when they're young, when they're juveniles. And it's pretty likely that it's young females that are establishing new breeding sites. Now, males will explore areas nearby because when they're young, they really aren't contenders at the breeding beaches and often will hang out at beaches that are peripheral to the breeding beaches so they don't get beat up as much and they don't lose as much energy. So there are occasionally times where you'll see sites where there are lots of what we call subadult males hanging out, but no females. And what would make it a new breeding site would be the arrival of new females. And we think that it's the younger females that are willing to explore new areas. And once we get a female or several females, typically they want to be in a harem because it does help protect them and their pups from the males fighting and all of those things. Once you get a few of them that decide that that's an okay beach to have pups, then you'll get males who know that females show up, and then they start to come back to those beaches year after year.
So it's kind of both the males have to be out there hanging out, and the females have got to arrive, otherwise the males are out of luck.
Yes. But we think it's happening pretty early. We don't know for sure, but it seems that once they find a good breeding site, then they tend to come back to that same site year after year. And so it looks like the younger ones are the ones that explore new areas to haul out.
And then, there have been a lot of tagging studies, have there?
There have.
Yeah.
Yes, so mostly out of Santa Cruz.
When they breed, how long a process is that? So they haul out and the males do all the fighting and then eventually do breeding. And are the females giving birth at the same time? I know some of these pinnipeds do that. The females give birth and are immediately impregnated. And then they carry the implanted embryo for several months before it begins to develop. Do elephant seals have a similar strategy?
Yes, elephant seals have delayed implantation. So for them, the female will come ashore when she's about ready to give birth. It usually takes maybe up to a week before she has her pup, usually a few days. And once she gives birth to her pup, she is going to nurse it for that 4 weeks. And she comes into estrus when her pup weans. Uh-huh. And then that's when the male will mate with her. So there is a month there after birth that she isn't really receptive. And once the pup weans, sometimes that's induced by the male coming in and separating the two of them. Sometimes it's induced by her separating from her pup on her own. And she'll come into estrus and the male will mate with her. But we think, and we don't know for sure because this part happens at sea, but after she mates with the male, she goes out to her foraging migration. And we know that then she's going to come back at almost exactly the same time next year. So we think that it's still a 9-month gestation period, which means that we're going to have a pause. So we think in pinnipeds, embryonic diapause happens after the embryo develops a little bit. And then it sort of stops developing and it doesn't quite implant. And then, so we're looking at a month or two later, the embryo will implant and continue the development in the female. And sometimes we think implantation might be dependent on her success in that early part of the foraging migration, that it might not take if she's not doing well that year.
Sure.
I'm a little confused. How does reproduction, where they're on shore for the pupping and so forth, and molting, how do those fit together? Don't they molt every year? And is that before or after or independently of the reproductive time on shore?
Two separate times. So the breeding season is just the breeding season, and then the females will go feed, and they'll come back in late spring, and then they'll do their molt. And then they'll go for another foraging migration before coming back for the breeding season. The males stay a little longer during the breeding season, so they take a little longer on their post-breeding migration and will come back to molt later than the females.
I see.
Interesting.
But they're two separate times in their lives, and so the behavior's totally different as well, but they're not overlapping in time in terms of when breeding happens and when molting happens.
And it sounds like they're living separate lives, except for this period of maybe 4 to 6 weeks on the breeding beaches, right? The rest of the time.
That's exactly right, because the males and females typically don't even molt at the same time. So Essentially, they don't see each other until the breeding season the following year.
Yeah. Interesting. That's another thing they have in common with seabirds.
Yeah. Except there's no parental care from the males in,
oh, really?
In marine mammals. Yeah.
Yeah. That was my next question. What happens to the pup when, so the female nurses for 4 weeks or so, and then the pup weans, is it driven off the beach? Does it just hang out? What happens to the pup while the females and the males are starting to get together?
Yeah, so once they wean, the pups tend to congregate in what we call wiener pods. They're called wieners because they've just weaned from mom. And they sort of congregate together. They try to get away from the harems at that point, although occasionally, initially, they might hang out in the harem, maybe hoping they're still going to get some milk from somebody. But eventually, they tend to congregate still on the same breeding beach. Typically, once in a while, they'll move to a different beach, but usually it's the same beach and they kind of move off away from the harems off to the side and they hang out together. And they need another 6 to 8 weeks before they're really ready to get in the water, but they will sometimes splash at the tide line, or if they're at a beach that has some freshwater runoff, a lot of the pups like to practice holding their breath and swimming in some of the streams that come out on the beaches. And that helps them to kind of build up their physiology, because they're really not ready to get in right at that 4 week mark. They need more time to develop that, the oxygen stores that we talked about, and their ability to hold their breath before they can really go out to sea and start to forage. Now, how do they know that? We have no idea. It all seems to be based on instinct, and they'll hang out for 6 to 8 weeks, and then something clicks in them that maybe they're hungry enough that now it's time to go eat, but they don't really go out until they go out, and then it's that foraging migration happening for them.
Interesting.
Have you put sat tags on any of these newly weaned pups to figure out how deep they dive?
That is one of our current research projects right now. My graduate student has been putting out satellite tags on newly weaned elephant seals, and we are trying to understand where they go, how deep they go. We're seeing, as we talked about, lots of individual variation, and it appears at this early stage, I don't want to give too much away, but it doesn't look like we're seeing the same patterns with males versus females at that life stage, that they are not necessarily following the patterns that the adults show. We had a female this year go up to Alaska. In fact, on her return trip, she looked like she was using those seamounts you mentioned. And we had a male go relatively offshore. So lots of variation among the individuals, and we're trying to build up our sample size to say something more. It's hard because we can't get the full dive record unless we get the tag back. And unfortunately, the first year of life out at sea is a really high mortality life stage for these animals. The estimated mortality is about 60%. So maybe only 40% of them survived that first foraging migration. And that's of the ones that weaned successfully.
Yeah. Sure. Because it sounds like they have no parental guidance. So they have to get out there and figure out everything on their own, how to catch fish and everything.
That's right. It blows my mind. I don't understand how they do it. It's all instinctual. And as far as we know, they don't hunt together either. They're not social in their feeding in the way that we might see with, say, sea lions or something, where they would concentrate around a bait ball and work together. As far as we know, these are our animals are just foraging individually out in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
Wow.
And trying to avoid predators.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So it makes them harder to find for a pack of orcas. But it also, that also leads to 60% mortality.
That's right.
So we haven't talked about lifespan for these animals.
Well, for females, we think they live to be in their mid-20s. And the folks at Onion and Waver are going to have better data on that, because they have a lot more animals that have flipper tags, which I don't think I mentioned, but that's one of the ways that we identify animals throughout their lifetime. We use sheep ear tags, but we put them into the webbing in between their digits on their hind flippers. And there are different colors for different rookeries. So the color of the tag tells you where the animal was tagged. And so based on the data from Anyo, we believe that the females live to be in their 20s. Males' life is a bit shorter. It's going to be, I think they're getting old around once they're hitting the double digits. So 10, 11, 12 might be old for a male elephant seal.
Interesting. So the females are living about twice as long.
Mm-hmm.
And sea otters, I know you can pull a tooth or get a tooth out of a skeleton that's washed ashore and, section it and then count the years from the layers that are in the tooth. Is there anything like that in elephant seals? Is there anything beside the flipper tags that can give you a clue?
Yes, we could age them by their teeth. Okay. Most of the time, animals don't die on shore. Most of them die at sea, and so it's really hard for us to recover parts like that in order to age them. So that's why it's helpful to have the kinds of long-term studies where we can follow known age individuals or know how old they live to be, because it's very rare to find particularly adult elephant seals on shore that have deceased.
Right, right. They spend 98% of their time in the ocean, so if they died, it's more likely to be out there, right?
Right, yes. And they're not feeding in the nearshore marine environment like sea otters are.
Yeah.
Right, so they're not going to wash ashore when they die typically either.
Right. I do remember one that did a few years ago. I got a text from a captain of a charter boat. He had found a dead one floating off Westport, and I got in touch with Sarah Grimes, and she figured out which beach it was going to end up on, and 2 days later she went and found it. So
that's amazing.
A rare find, I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because normally, you know, especially females, they're so far offshore, they're never going to wash up on a beach.
Not if they die at sea.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Dr. Liwanag, we are just about out of time in this interview. The hour has flown by. I don't know about our listeners, but I sure have enjoyed hearing about this, and I think we could probably talk with you for another hour and learn more fascinating things about these incredible animals. If there's anything you want our listeners to take away, now is the time to mention it, and then we will wrap up.
Well, I hope that they appreciate how incredible elephant seals are, having come back from the brink of extinction and having all these really amazing adaptations that allow them to thrive both on the coastline and at the middle of the Pacific. They're just an incredible creature, and I hope that they can appreciate how and also the privilege that we get to be able to see them the short time that they're on land, and to appreciate this animal that's really built for the ocean, but it's tied to the shore for these parts of its life where we get to see it. I know people think they look silly on land, and they kind of do, but frankly, we look silly in the water. Mm-hmm. So I hope they can appreciate how incredible they are, because they're just an amazing example of evolution and also what conservation can do to help the critters in our ocean.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the Ecology Hour.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's a fascinating conversation. You did a great job. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Ecology Hour on KZYX. Our guest tonight has been Dr. Heather Liwanag of the University of California. She's an associate professor and talking about the remarkable physiology of elephant seals. We will have some links and more information on our website at ecologyhour.wordpress.com if you'd like to follow up on the topic. Thanks for listening, and have a pleasant evening.